I'm joined by Dr. V. Michael Jones, editor and publisher of Culture Wars, author of many books. He holds a doctorate in English literature. Author of an upcoming book on Logos. Michael, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Michael, good you have a book coming up. Yep. You got a book coming up on the subject of Logos. So I want to, although, you know, you've discussed this at length on other programs, I'd like you to give a thumbnail sketch on what you mean by Logos and how you define the term.
Basically, we're talking about man and in his history, aware that there's something called some ultimate reality. We all have the sense that there's some type of ultimate reality out there. And primitive man was no exception in this regard. The first reaction of primitive man to this recognition is to talk about God. This is before any type of religion that we know, before Judaism, before Christianity, before Buddhism, before anything. All primitive peoples had the sense that there was a God out there, that the God was a man. He referred to him as a father, and that he lived in the sky. At this point, human reason failed. At this point, you enter the realm of mythology. So, which meant an extrapolation from what you knew, which is true that God is a father. He lives in the sky in some sense or other. And so they started speculating, well, if God's a father, then he must have a beard, right? And if he has a beard, he probably doesn't shave. And he probably has a wife. And what's his wife's name then? And you go, all the speculation just goes down a blind alley, okay? The ultimate destination of all this could be, you could talk about India as the ultimate destination, because at a certain point, they had a notion of Urta, which is ultimate reality in the Vedas, and then they ended up with 33 million gods, which is where they are today. Okay? At this point, people began, so the culmination of this in what we know would be something like the Iliad and the Odyssey. The Iliad is basically the story of man's relationship to the gods, but the gods are all just like human beings. They are exactly what I described. You know, Zeus has a wife and he gets angry and she gets angry and they're fighting up in heaven the same way the Greeks and the Trojans are fighting down on earth. And at a certain point, everybody, general consciousness in a place like Greece realized that this is kind of childish. They're nice stories, but they're kind of childish. And at that point, people started wondering about reality. Let's take a step back from the ultimate reality and let's talk about the reality that we all know. And people in Ionia, which were Greek colonies on the coast of the Persian Empire, on the other side of the Aegean Sea, started to think, well, maybe the ultimate reality is like the reality. So maybe Thales said it's water, and then Anaxagoras said it was air, and Heraclitus said it was fire. But the problem here is you're reducing it to something that is material. And at this point, there was a breakthrough. Heraclitus is the man who came up with it. He did talk about the ultimate reality being fire, but fire is ultimately energy. And energy is a form in a way that like the flame on a candle is like a form. It's always changing and it's always the same. And the idea that brings these two things together is Logos. That's the way he used Logos, was a kind of like, a tension of opposites. And at that point, there was this big leap forward. At that point, the ultimate reality became something that was not material. You could not make a picture of this. You could not find it in this world. You could not go like to the ocean and stick your foot in it. You could not breathe it. You could not touch it. It was, if you want to call it mental, that's one way of dealing with it. And that was where things stopped because they didn't have instruments to take it any further. No microscope, no telescope. no Atom Smasher, no nothing. And at that point, everybody in Greece got tired of talking about things that they couldn't really develop any further. And the whole tenor of Greek philosophy shifted away from that to basically, let's win law cases. Let's win lawsuits. Let's have practical philosophy. And these people were known as sophists. And they started coaching people on how to be effective speakers and so on and so forth. But they were so bent on winning cases for their clients that they basically dispensed from any of the important things of life. And this is why they incurred the anger of Socrates, who said, well, you know, there are important things. If you're going to have a court case, what about justice? And again, here we go, another step beyond something that's not quite material. It's not like winning a case. It's like there are abstract principles. And these people took this far. The sophist created Socrates. Socrates created Plato, and Plato had a very definite understanding of how the universe fit together. And then his disciple was Aristotle, and he went back to the whole notion of let's study the physical world. But he didn't go completely back. And so at this point, Aristotle said there has to be some type of ultimate reality again. He's not going to go back to the errors of Thales. He's not going to say it's water. He understands that the world of ideas had moved forward with Heraclitus. And he came up with the idea that there was a God and that God was the unmoved mover. The uncaused cause and the unmoved mover. And he says this very eloquently in The Metaphysics, which is a very important book. Most people who talk about metaphysics don't know what they're talking about. We have biologists now like Richard Dawkins, who claims to be talking about ultimate reality, but all he's talking about is his ideological version of biology, which is Darwinism, which is an inadequate form of metaphysics. Right. He doesn't understand that. That is the point. So at this point, philosophy stopped again. Basically, with Aristotle got a job. And his day job, was teaching a man by the name of Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great was no philosopher, but he was a great military man, and he conquered the world. And in doing this, he spread Greek thought throughout the world, and it became the vehicle for thinking in the world at that time. Okay?
Right. I sort of approach this from a Judaic standpoint, and I do so as a believer, in that I believe that Logos emanated from Sinai when God revealed himself to the children of Israel. And basically, they became aware of the fact that there was a lawgiver, there was a creator of the universe, there was a king of the universe, and that it was outside of man. And that going into the origins of the Torah, it had to do with the rebellion of the very first parents, Eve and Adam, who entered into a conspiracy to try to overthrow God in heaven by participating in the forbidden fruit. And ever since then, in every generation, we've had people or groups of people who have tried to overthrow the logos of the universe by trying to replace God in heaven with themselves. It's communist spy and later novelist Whittaker Chambers referred to this in the introduction to his famous book, Witness, when he talks about the man has a choice between God and man, and that communism he referred to as the world's second oldest religion. It was the conspiracy of the Garden of Eden, and of course God responded to that by withdrawing slightly from engagement with man and leaving man up to his own devices. But I see that as the origin of Logos.
Look, you're right. There were two tracks here. Okay. I'm talking about man just by himself, just trying to figure things out. And that would be the Greek track. But the Hebrew track is different, because the Hebrew track is basically God revealing himself to man and explaining something that man could never figure out. So you have And what you're talking about here is faith or reason, okay? And so God did appear to Moses on Mount Sinai. Moses saw him face to face and didn't die. And so God tells Moses he's got to do something, and Moses says, okay, I'll do that, but I have to know who you are, and so tell me who you are. And he said, I am who am. Now, I don't think Moses understood this. I don't think anybody understood this, whether on top of the mountain or below the mountain, anywhere on the face of the earth. But this is what God said, and it means that basically God is self-subsistent being, which is very similar to what Aristotle said when he said he was the unmoved mover. God told this to Moses 1,000 years before Aristotle figured it out on his own. Okay, and then it was told to the, it was given to the Hebrew people as a revelation, as sort of their constitution. Moses brought it down from the mountain, okay, the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and there they are worshiping the golden calf, and now you have the whole problematic history of Hebrews in relationship to God and the covenant they established. Okay, I'm saying that these two traditions came together, and they came together when Jesus Christ came on this earth. And they came together. Now, Jesus Christ was no Greek philosopher, okay? He was his mission was only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But after he died, there was a group of people who decided to spread his message. The main man in this regard was Paul, who was a Pharisee who persecuted the Christians until God knocked him off his horse. Now, Aquinas said there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the signs and wonders people, and there are the philosophers. Paul was a signs and wonder guy. He not only was he knocked off his horse, he was taken up into heaven, and God showed him heaven, and he came back down, and he goes from one synagogue to another now. And preaching the new way, and there is a split now among the Hebrew people. We're still talking about an intra-Hebrew conflict here, and the Jews who accepted Jesus Christ are known as Christians at this point, and the Jews who rejected Jesus Christ are known as Jews, and the Jews expelled Paul from the synagogues. Okay, Paul tried it. At a certain point, the Jews won't let him into the synagogues anymore. And at this point, he has a vision. He's always having visions. And the vision is some guy in Macedonia kind of waving him over, come over here. And so he sails to Greece. And he goes to Greece. Not only does he go there, he goes to Athens, which is the center of Greek philosophy. And he goes not only that, to the Areopagus. The Areopagus are the elite Greek philosophers, the people who know Plato and Aristotle. And in my humble opinion, he gives exactly the wrong speech. Okay, now he's used to going to synagogues and he's saying, well, Jesus, his father was so-and-so, and it goes all the way back to Abraham. So this is the Messiah. That's the genealogy that is the beginning of the Gospel of St. Matthew. He goes to the Greeks and he says, well, basically there's this guy and he's really concerned about you and he rose from the dead. And the Greeks say, well, he rose from the dead. Huh? Well, we'll talk to you about that some other time. We'll see you later. And he failed. He failed. And I think the man who understood that he failed was St. John, who was in Ephesus at the time. They were all traveling around Ephesus. Ephesus was a huge center on the coastline, again, in Ionia. Ephesus is the home of Heraclitus. And so what John does is basically bring these two traditions together. So the first sentence of his gospel, it's not a genealogy anymore. No, Greeks don't care who your father was, who his father was. He begins with a metaphysical treatise, and he says, in the beginning, there was Logos. Now, in the beginning are the first three words of Genesis. So this is a kind of new Genesis, and John brings together the Greek and the Hebrew traditions in a new synthesis, and that synthesis is Christianity, and the world has changed at that point. Because at this point, he takes that whole Greek, he says, in the beginning, there was Logos. All right, the Greeks will understand you now. The people on the Areopagus will understand what you're talking about now. And then he says, Logos was with God, and Logos is God. Well, that's a whole new ball game, because the Greeks were kept thinking of geometry, or astronomy, and it turns out that that's not false, but it's actually a person. That Logos is really a person, and this person is God, which means he has the power to impose this plan on human history, and that's exactly what he does.
No, I think that's quite true and quite brilliant. I mean, I get that St. John brought together Greek philosophy, which was Logos, without necessarily including, but at that point including, all of the moral and ethical precepts of the Torah as given at Sinai. And that was what was missing in the Greek understanding. And I think that St. John, the gospel author, brought that into the mix and in a sense created a faith that included both. I think Judaism also had the same synthesis many, many hundreds of years earlier due to the influence of the Greeks on, you know, the on the Second Commonwealth of Judea, and that the Talmud also synthesizes both Greek understanding and Torah understanding.
The main guy in this regard is Philo of Alexandria.
Sure.
A Jew who was a Platonist, well aware of Greek philosophy. The turning point, the difference between Philo of Alexandria and John is that Philo said that Jesus was a creature. In other words, Jesus was a man. And here you get into the biggest crisis for the first four centuries of Christianity. Was Jesus God and man? Was he God who looked like a man? Was he a man who thought he was God? And back and forth, all of this conflict. Okay, Philo clearly came down on one side in this issue. He said Jesus Christ was a creature. He was created by God. If you're created by God, you are not God. This is not what John said. John said,
That's a question of Christology, and I don't really want to go too deeply into that, only in that it's a Christian question. But I will go so far as to suggest that putting aside the divinity of Jesus as man, God, or God, one of the factors that seems to me to be overlooked by Christians, and that has everything to do with Logos, is that Jesus was a Jew. And Jesus' ministry was steeped in Judaism. Jesus, because I've had a chance to go back and do some review of the New Testament, actually since the last time we talked. And I'm not claiming to be a scholar at all, but it seems to me that his ministry and his utterances were filled with Pharisaic Judaism. I mean, it did not contradict at all, and that the arguments that he was having with the Pharisees were Jewish arguments that go on today in Jewish circles. I mean, these are questions of understanding the Torah, and his criticism of the Pharisees was totally a Jewish criticism. It's the same criticism I would lodge at Judaism today as a Jew. It's, you know, the struggle within the Jewish understanding and the Jewish experience. It goes all the way back to what you mentioned earlier, Moses coming down and finding that they're with the golden calf. I mean, it is, in a sense, the struggle of all of mankind. It reflects that, to understand the nature of Logos, to understand our role in the universe, and to contrast that with all of the earthly temptations that draw us away from that. And that's a reflection of existence, actually.
The issue here is exactly what I stated. It's the Trinity. That's basically what those first three sentences mean. So in the beginning there was Logos. Logos was with God, and Logos is God. Well, how can you be with God and God at the same time? That's basically what we're talking about here when we're talking about the Trinity. So we're talking about someone, Jesus Christ was not created by God the Father. He was begotten by God the Father, which means he's on the same level as God the Father. This is a crucial turning point in human history. Okay, at this point, this is something that Aristotle could have never figured out. It solved the Plato-Aristotle problem, because Plato said God was the demiurge But that means he's not really eternal or God. And Aristotle said, well, he's the eternal uncaused cause, but that doesn't explain how he deals with time. So you got a problem here. This resolves that problem because God is both God the Father, he's the being, he's also God the Son, which is knowing, and he's also God the Holy Spirit, which is loving or acting. And you put these three things together, and you have a transcendent being who can act in the world, and that resolved the philosophical problem of the Greeks. And the world moved forward at that point. You cannot stop at these points in history. And the point that I'm trying to make here is either you get this right or you don't move forward in history. And I'm saying two of the groups that didn't move forward in history were the Jews. Okay, they did not move forward. They stuck with this antiquated notion of God, Jesus. They recognized him, but they said he was a creature. And they had a huge influence on another group that came along known as the Muslims. Okay, the Muslims basically got there. They knew who Jesus was. You can't live in the 6th century after Christ and not know who he is, even if you're in the middle of the Arabian Peninsula, out in the desert, in the middle of nowhere. You're still hearing these stories. And this is the position of Muhammad, hearing these new stories, coming up with a new Bible called the Quran, based on his mishmash, a mishmash of misunderstandings taken from both the Old Testament and the New Testament.
You know, those people. Yeah, I mean, I just want to interject here. And look, I understand that I have an enormous amount of respect for the Trinity and the concept of that. I think that actually made a sort of a backdoor entrance into Judaism in the form of the Kabbalah, which has the trilogy in it, Trinity in it. And it also has an end time scenario that's very similar to the Christian understanding of the book of Revelation, John of Patmos. But I would point out that the Jewish understanding of God is as a covenant that continues to this day. I mean, that our experience with God is much more serious and much more intimate than that, I would argue, of any other group in the world. We've been walking with God 1,000 years before Christianity was created. I mean, we have a much more direct, much more intimate understanding of not only the God or the creator of the universe, but the giver of law. And it has everything to do with Jewish life. Even secular Jews, to a certain extent, even though they've stepped away from it, there's a much more profound understanding. And I'm not saying this to suggest Christians don't have that. And again, I honor the idea of the Trinity and all of that because I think it's resulted in Christians believing in God. As far as Islam goes, I think Islam was influenced both by Christianity and Judaism. Yes. That Muhammad's teacher, this guy named Zayd, believed, and in fact, he had a religion called Zaydism that was a very literal follower of Abraham and nothing more. It was like a very direct personal relationship, like he would walk with God. And it was something that predates, in a way, both Judaism and Christianity. And I think that Islam incorporated a lot of that because Muhammad embraced that. And it created a very purified form of belief that is believing in God, but yet doesn't have the moral and ethical laws of the Torah. It doesn't have Jesus as an intercessor. You know, it doesn't have any of those things, and that it resulted in a rather hybridized religion that we have today.
Yes, the Jewish people, as I said before, had a unique relationship with God. There's no question about it. The problem came when Jesus Christ arrived on this earth. Jesus Christ was the Messiah. At this point, the Jewish people have to decide, are we going to accept the Messiah on his terms? Because they weren't the terms that they expected. And so you have this huge conflict that is described basically in the Gospel of St. John when he gets to the historical narrative of Jews kind of going to Jesus and saying, well, we're special. We have special DNA. We are the seed of Abraham. And Jesus kind of saying, you know, God doesn't need your DNA. God can create rocks, create people from rocks. He doesn't need anything. Certainly doesn't need your DNA. And they get furious at him. And at that point, you have this confrontation. Are you calling us bastards? We're children of Moses. And Jesus said, no, you're not children of Moses. You had to accept me in order to be a child of Moses. And at that point, he says, your father is Satan. And of course, at that point, you can see this where this is going to end. The Jews killed Christ. The Jews killed Christ. And at that point, they lost their status as God's chosen people. And it was replaced by the Catholic Church and Christianity.
You know, at the part of the St. John that you're quoting has sort of, I don't know, I would, for lack of a better term, somewhat of a racist element to it, both for and against Jews. I mean, on the one hand, you have the Jews claiming some sort of a racial identity, which, by the way, is not really a part of Judaism. And then on the other hand, you have St. John putting in the mouth of Jesus the claim that the Jews are the spawn of Satan, which is a racist comment. And in a way, if Jesus had said that, wouldn't he be saying that he himself is the spawn of Satan? Wouldn't he be saying that his mother was the spawn of Satan? I mean,
this,
that,
at
know,
this
spawn
point,
means
at
race,
this,
racial.
At this point, we have to go back to the Gospel of St. John and ask the question, what do you mean by a Jew? Was Jesus a Jew? There's a passage here in the Gospel of St. John that I've quoted before, but it says, the parents of the man born blind refused to speak out of fear of the Jews, because the Jews threatened to expel from the synagogue anyone who said that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. Well, they obviously have the same DNA as the people that are unhappy with them. You cannot, there is no racial explanation of what is going on here. Okay, the term Jew at this point means a rejecter of Jesus Christ, and that means a rejecter of Logos. That is the meaning of this term. So when you say the Jews killed Christ, what do you mean by that? Do you mean that the Blessed Mother shouted, crucify him? Did St. John shout, crucify him? No, the Jews killed Christ. The Jews are the people, the Hebrew people, who rejected Jesus Christ. These are the people who are known as Jews. The Jews, the Hebrew people who accepted Jesus Christ, had the same DNA, but they are known as the church, and that is the new Israel, which replaces the old Israel.
The Blessed Mother was also considered and thought of herself as a Jew. And look,
did you just listen to what I said, though? I mean, you were going back to what I just refuted.
Yeah, let's not do circular reasoning here. I'll simply add that there was a sectarian divide at the time. It's very similar to, for example, the Roman Catholic Church saying that any Catholic who's, and this has been changed, I think, since Vatican II, I don't know, but that if a Catholic's foot so much as crossed the threshold of a Protestant church, they would be in mortal sin, right? You know, these are sectarian divides that I don't know exactly what the early church said about a Jew crossing into their particular place of worship, but there was obviously, if you take a look at it, at what was going on at that time, there was a serious division within Judaism. There are two sects of Judaism that emerged after the destruction of the Second Temple. That was the Pharisees and the Christians. And they did not, you know, there was a major, there was unpleasantries on both sides. Let's put it that way. You know, I mean, the people that wrote, St. John wrote that gospel about 100 years after Jesus. And it must have been influenced by the times in which he lived, where there was this struggle between these two sects, mainly for the heart and soul of the Roman Empire. And that the Christian sect at that time, I mean, I don't think that I'm saying anything here that's casting a dispersion. I understand it. But I think at that time, they were currying favor with the Romans because they wanted to proselytize in Rome. And thus, they were emphasizing the Jewish complicity as opposed to the Roman complicity, first of all, in the crucifixion, and secondly, in terms of compatibility with Roman society. And it was actually Christians, early Christians, who had implored Trajan, the Emperor Trajan, who was going to rebuild the temple. They said, no, don't do that. You know, you can't, you know what I mean? So there was definitely an internecine struggle at that time between these two groups. And I think we need to understand this in that context.
Well, sure, there was a struggle. I've already talked about the struggle. Say, Paul was intimately involved in the struggle. He went from one side of the battle to the other side, you know, switched sides in this struggle. But what does that, are we trying to relativize the nature, the meaningfulness of this struggle out of existence by just saying it's an internecine struggle between two groups of Jews? First of all, I as I said, it's not groups of Jews anymore. The Jews are the people who are holding on to that old tradition. They're the people who are called Jews. The Jews, the Hebrews, the people with that DNA who have left and accepted Jesus Christ as the Messiah are known as Christians. And that's a turning point in history. We all know that. We all know that. Okay. Why is this year 2019? Okay. Why isn't it 2870? Well, because we don't date time from the founding of the city of Rome. We date it from the time of Jesus Christ. So we all know that. I'm just trying to talk about the philosophical implications of this. And that goes back to those statements by St. John at the beginning. So let's eliminate all the polemic and just concentrate on those statements. This solved the Greeks' problem, the Greeks' ultimate reality problem. There was now a solution out there, but it took time to work through this thing. And I'm saying that if you don't accept this, okay, if you don't accept this new understanding of Logos, you get left behind. You get left behind by history, okay? You cannot participate in the forward movement of Logos. So again, let's back away from the Jewish thing. Let's talk about the Muslim thing, okay? It's kind of more neutral ground here. Basically, the Muslims had Aristotle long before anybody in Europe had Aristotle, okay? Science should have developed in the Islamic world way before it developed in the 17th century in Europe. But it didn't. And the question is, why didn't it do this? And that has to do with a struggle, an internal struggle among the Muslims themselves.
You know, first of all, I mean, I think that when I take a look at Jewish logos, as it were, I would point out that there are several passages and I don't dispute the fact that the ministry of Jesus brought Logos to the world. I think it did so for putting aside the question of his messiahship. I think it did so because Jesus was a Jew, and it brought forth a Jewish understanding of the universe to the rest of the world, merged with a Greek understanding. But the Jewish understanding is what brought the moral and ethical element to the world that has been a backbone of Western civilization. But Jesus himself in the New Testament, and I've talked about this with you, and I'm not going to quote it exactly, but in the book of Matthew and again in the book of Acts, and I don't think Christians look at the New Testament as literally the word of God anyways. It's not like the way Muslims look at the Quran. But in his mouth is placed the statement that the covenant between the Jewish people and God is forever. Now, that is exactly the understanding that we have. The Mosaic covenant remains. We have adhered to that covenant. It's not outdated. That there was not a new covenant. It wasn't a new covenant. It was a renewed covenant. That was what Jesus was talking about in his lifetime, in the same way that Rabbi Hillel, who is his contemporary, was talking about. We need to bring people back to Logos. It was at a time of a low time in Jewish experience. The brutal, you know, jackboot of the Roman Empire was on the Jewish neck. And it was a renewal of the covenant. And in that sense, I would suggest that Jesus was messianic in that his ministry brought that covenant to the entire Gentile world in a way that the Jewish, other Jewish leaders never could. So, yeah. You know, we're not going to agree on whether or not the covenant between God and the Jews is forever or is relevant. I say it is, you say it's not, and your evidence is because Christianity became the religion of the world. I would suggest that the Jewish faith, and this is maybe something that I can't prove, maybe if I spent the rest of my life researching this, maybe I could develop it, but I would argue that the Jewish presence in Europe, which precedes the Christian presence, and which was there for 1,000 years during the height of the Roman Catholic presence, that presence gave a backbone to Catholicism. And if it hadn't been for the Jews of Europe, Catholic Europe would have sunk back to paganism. It was our continually conducting the understand the worship of God the way we did and the covenant the way we did, that provided a moral underpinning for Roman Catholicism for 1,000 years. What say you?
That's not what Heinrich Graetz says. First of all, Talmudic Judaism is newer than Christianity. It was created after Christianity as an anti-Christian ideology, and it is not the word of God. No Jew would ever say it was the word of God. And it is contradicts the word of God, and that's the verdict of Heinrich Graetz, the father of Jewish historiography, who says basically that the Talmud taught Jews how to cheat people, and that was it led to the moral corruption of Jews. So I would say I would disagree with your premise, and it wasn't Judaism that kept Christianity going; it was Christianity's opposition to Judaism that helped Europe to develop out of the bad habits that it had had under the Roman Empire, specifically usury. The Jews never got over their addiction to usury. It was always a corrupting influence on every country. The main reason Jews got expelled from 109 countries throughout history is usury. It's that simple. You get the people in debt. The people can't pay off their debts. They can't figure out why they have to pay 5 times the principal of a loan over this period of time. They get annoyed, and they know where the creditors are, and they go and they burn the Jews' house down because that's where the records are, and the Jews get expelled. So no, it wasn't the Jews who created Europe. It was the Jews were a drag on Europe. They were tolerated as aliens. They were known to be subversive to the moral order, but they were tolerated because Jesus Christ said you're supposed to love your enemies. That's secret Judaeus non in a nutshell. That changed when Napoleon basically emancipated the Jews. Up until that time, they were tolerated, but they weren't citizens. After that, what you had was a catastrophe for France. This is when the Jewish question arose in earnest, because once you allow the Jews full citizenship, they exploit that to their advantage. They enslave the people in usury, and the people get furious again. And that led to by the end of the 19th century, everybody's talking about the Jewish question, including the Roman Catholic Church. Civiltà Cattolica does a 3-part series on the Jewish question because it's a serious problem. And their conclusion is basically it all goes back to Napoleon. He emancipated the Jews. You give these people rights, and they abuse the rights, and they have basically alienated everyone in our society. Now, to get back to the covenant issue, it's a thorny issue. Paul talks about it he says, yes, the God's not going to go back on his promises, but the covenant is a two-way street here, and the Jews cannot fulfill the covenant that they made with Moses. They can't do it anymore because they don't have a temple, they don't have a priesthood, and they don't have sacrifice. At this point, there's a new covenant. That's the term that the church uses. And Peter, when he goes to Jerusalem, is the one who articulates the terms of the new covenant. He goes to Jerusalem, he walks up to the Jews, and he says, "You killed Christ." At this point, the Jews are cut to the heart because he says it with conviction, and they say, "What must we do to be saved?" This is all in the Acts of the Apostles. And Peter says, "You have to be baptized." Okay, so the Jews can be saved, but they have to be saved now according to the new covenant, because the old covenant can't be fulfilled anymore. It's over. You don't have any possibility of fulfilling it. It has to be the new covenant. And these are the terms of the new covenant.
Okay, well, first of all, I mean, we're obviously not going to agree about this. And I just, as an aside, I want to point out that Heinrich Graetz was a very close friend of Karl Marx. They used to summer together in Bohemia. He was a leftist. He was a progressive. He was not a friend of conventional Judaism. He was part of the Haskalah movement. So I think we need to understand his comments in context. The Talmud is commentary on the Torah. The Talmud was created around the same time as the New Testament. It's not newer. It was created during the Emperor Antonius Marcus Aurelius, who corresponded with Judah the Prince, the rabbi that first codified the Mishnah. And then the Gemara came a little bit later. But that's when they started to write down laws that would help the Jewish people continue at a time when we had clearly lost control of Judea. The Judaism does not require temple worship to conduct its affairs. That's not even in the Torah.
I didn't say Judaism. I said the Mosaic Covenant. Judaism, Talmudic Judaism was created after the destruction of the temple, because there was a vacuum that obviously they couldn't have the same type of Judaism because they had no temple. So they created the synagogue, which basically became a debating society. And that debate came to be codified as the Talmud. And that was published, the Babylonian Talmud was published in 600 AD, which is significantly after all of the gospel.
It started with the Mishnah, the Talmud, the Gemara came afterwards. But let me be more precise. The temple worship was not the central theme of the covenant. There was the covenant before the first temple. There was the covenant between the first and second temples. And there was the covenant after the second temple. Basically, the synagogue is a place to worship for the community. And that the Talmud ingeniously was able to replace the temple worship with a more symbolic type of worship that would be conducted until the reconstruction of the temple, in the same way that Catholics conduct the Mass as a reconstruction.
Not the same. The Catholic Mass is the replication of the temple. It is the priesthood. We have a priesthood. The Catholic Church has a priesthood. It has a sacrifice, and it has a temple. So it is the replacement of temple worship. The Jews simply, of course, they had to come up with some type of alternative because they didn't have a temple. That happened. Yochanan ben Zakkai went to Titus and begged for a favor because he was a friend of Rome. And he said, let me found a school. And he founded the school in Yavne because they had no alternative. There's no temple. So you have to come up with something new. This has been termed Judaism, but it is certainly not the covenant. It's not the covenant of Moses at all.
We disagree on that. There were synagogues many, many centuries before the destruction of the temple. They go back to Ezra.
But after the temple, you have only synagogues and no temple.
But the point is, synagogue worship had already replaced the temple anyway, because the temple had become, it was under the control of the Sadducees, who were really collaborators with the Romans. And it was not trusted at that point anyway. Even in the first temple period, there was alternatives. The prophets railed against the temple. If you take a look at the prophecy of Isaiah and Jeremiah, they did so openly at the temple in the same way Jesus did, by the way. You know, it's a long tradition in Judaism. It's not centered strictly on the temple. The temple's part of it, but Judaism and the covenant, it's not even mentioned at all in the five books of Moses, which is considered the technically considered the Torah. So Judaism and that covenant, I would suggest, and we're not going to agree, continues. And I would also suggest that in many ways, a miraculous proof of the validity of that covenant was manifest in 1948 with the creation of and the declaration of the State of Israel.
Chuck, oy vey. Oy vey. What can I say other than oy vey when you bring this up?
Well,
sorry, but I don't see the hand of God in these Polish criminals and terrorists who show up in Palestine and start murdering and killing people and stealing the Palestinians' property. I don't see the hand of God in that at all. Shall we go through the terrorists, the Irgun, the people who are the founders of the State of Israel and their terrorist credentials, blowing up the King David Hotel, murdering Count Bernadotte? This is not the hand of God. This is the hand of something other, sinister force in human history.
It is the hand of God, the Lord God, King of the universe. Look, there was obviously a war, and it wasn't handed to the Israelis on a silver platter.
Were they terrorists or not? Was the Irgun a terrorist organization or not?
It may be in the same way that George Washington was a terrorist. I don't know. I mean, those things are relative. I would suggest that they were independence fighters for the Jewish people in Israel.
I think
and that the Jewish movement, wait a minute, the movement of the Jewish people to Israel is an organic, dynamic force that has happened in every generation from the time of the Second Temple till today. It wasn't something that was simply cooked out of thin air. I mean, we could look at the history of that going all the way back to the period of the Spanish Inquisition. When the Jews were driven out of Spain, there was their immigration to Palestine or Judea, as it were. At that time, it was called South Syria. And that this is part, it's a very central part of Judaism. It's a part of the Torah that Christians accept as the word of God. You know, this is the idea that
it didn't exist. It didn't exist until the end of the 19th century. How can it be a part of Judaism if it took 4,000 years to come into existence?
As Jews, we didn't have the strength, both physically or morally, to bring it about until that.
Zionism didn't come into existence until Theodore Herzl cooked up the idea.
I reject that. Zionism exists in every generation of the Jewish people. And I could point that out. We don't have the time to go through the history of it. It is an organic, essential, spiritual, and political part of the Jewish faith. And that Israel is both a political entity and it's also a spiritual entity. And this is something that I would suggest is or ought to be understood by Christianity, because you embrace the five books of Moses. And that's quite clear about Israel and its status as the that tiny speck of land, as being the footstool of God, as being the land that God commanded Abraham to go to and that Moses to go to. I mean, this is the whole theme is based on that. Every day the Jewish people turn to Jerusalem, and that's what they pray in that direction. That is a basic fundamental part of Judaism, whether people are political Zionists or not. It has everything to do with what we believe in.
Okay. I know I'm not going to convince you. I'm going to play your card now. I'm not going to convince you on this. So what should we talk about now?
Well, let's bring things up to the present and talk about what's going on. I mean, I don't want to go too much into detail on this because this program is going to be, I'm going to download it into YouTube. And I know that YouTube is involved with censorship right now. They've censored my show. They've censored you. I know that.
Let's talk about the ADL and YouTube censorship.
Well, I want to talk about that because I take issue with you. I'm not a fan of the ADL. I think that they're a leftist organization that promotes leftist causes. The issue that I have with your analysis is that you want to make this into a Jewish thing, you know, that this is a Jewish organization.
Am I mistaken there?
Yes, I could point out Muslim and Christian organizations that are very similar. They're leftist. That's what they have in common. And I'm also going to take issue with one aspect of a short book that you wrote that I'm not going to mention the title of, because this show will be banned if I do, that you know what I'm talking about.
Where you mean Jewish privilege?
Yes, that's right. Thank you, Michael. Okay, so maybe this you want the show to be banned? I mean, that won't serve either one of us.
Chuck, we have to be able to talk freely about these issues. You and I, Chuck, if it were between you and me, we wouldn't have problems here, would we? Because we can talk about these issues openly. If you and I can talk about these issues openly, why should YouTube want to ban us? They should promote this.
That's the facts. You and I can talk about it, and it won't be seen by anybody. So I want to try to walk a line here. I take issue with your analysis in that book, in that you talk about something that, in full disclosure, I know something about because my mother's family was involved in this, and that is the Jewish mobsters, okay? And their intersection with the ADL. First of all, I think that your analysis of this and of Meyer Lansky and those guys who were Jewish mobsters and who were bootleggers and all the rest, it's not accurate in that, you know, you don't mention the fact that Meyer Lansky's chief partner was a man by the name of Joseph P. Kennedy. Okay. Now I know this because I know this from my own family, who were not big players in it, but they were minor players. And he was a Roman Catholic. And you also don't mention the fact that there are Italian mobsters who were Catholics who had interaction with the Vatican right up until the time Pope John Paul II reformed that or began to reform it. That's public knowledge. That's been widely reported on. And I'm not bringing this up to cast aspersions on the Catholic Church. I'm simply pointing out that this is not, you act like this is some kind of a Jewish thing. That's a unique thing. The Jewish mobsters were junior partners to the Italian Catholic mob and those families in the United States. They were not the main players. And I think that the fact you bring this up in isolation and point out that the Jews are criminals and this kind of thing, it's not intellectually honest.
Okay, Mo Dalitz was head of the Jewish Navy. Is that an Italian operation or a Jewish operation?
Joseph P. Kennedy was also intimately involved.
I'm asking you a question, Chuck. Answer the question. Was the Jewish Navy an Italian operation or a Jewish operation?
It is a criminal operation that was run by Jews in the same way that the Bonanno family is a criminal operation run by Catholics.
Did I say all Jews are criminals? Did I say that?
The way you portray it implies it, yes.
What I'm trying to, first of all, Hollywood makes movies about Italian mobsters. You can't talk about Jewish mobsters. Because if you talk about Jewish mobsters, the ADL comes down on you and calls you an anti-Semite. This is what I'm referring to as Jewish privilege.
The Italian mobster movie you're talking about, that being Godfathers, has a major Jewish figure in it, based on Meyer Lansky. Right?
So no, I think it's Mo. You mean Mo Green?
Yeah.
I thought that was Mo Dalitz, but you may be right. I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's fiction. It's fiction. It doesn't matter. All I'm saying is that what with an organization like the ADL is basically a money laundering operation that his purpose is to keep Jewish criminals out of jail. Isn't that significant? Isn't that something we should talk about?
Yes, it is. And my answer to that is that you could find, and I'm not going to name names here, but I can point out in my own hometown of Boston, a very significant Catholic organization that has done the same thing for Catholic mobsters, giving them, after they go straight, they funnel money through. Now, look, this is what we're talking about here is a kind of corruption that is not to be hung at the door of either Jews or Catholics. I mean, these are people who are posing as Jews and Catholics. They are Jewish and Catholic. But it's not, the way you wrote about this, it's you make it as if this is somehow unique to Jews and that it's a Jewish thing. And that's
you misread what okay. I said, if you think that. Okay. Obviously, there are criminals in from all groups in this country. The problem here is that if you can't talk about Jewish criminals because of Jewish privilege being enforced by agencies like the ADL, which is, as I said, a money laundering operation, which now arrogates to itself the right to tell us what we're allowed to say on the internet. There's no organization like that out there of Catholics or Italians or Irish or Samoans or any other group in the world.
Well, yes, there is. But I dislike the fact that the ADL is involved in censorship. I don't think they're right about that.
Good. Well, then we agree. We agree
on that. The point I'm making is that this is not unique to them.
But it is unique to them. There's only one group that is the arbiter of the term hate speech, and it's the ADL.
We do talk about Jewish criminals. Look about these guys involved with a pharma drug company that just declared bankruptcy because they were promoting OxyContin.
You can say the Sackler family are involved in criminal activity, but as soon as you say the Jewish Sackler family, you're in trouble. Because you're an anti-Semite.
The point is, why the fact that they happen to be Jewish is not relevant.
Saying. But when you have a kind of coordinated effort throughout the entire culture of people that where you're not allowed to connect the dots, that's keeping us in a state of ignorance, and so therefore we can't protest properly.
Well, the thing is, I would suggest that the fact that some of these people have Jewish background is no more relevant than whether they have Catholic background. It doesn't matter whether they worship on Saturday or Friday or Sunday. The important factor is that they're criminals, and it's not a Jewish conspiracy. This isn't Jews involved in this. The Sackler family, who knows? I mean, they're all married to Gentiles, and I don't know if they could even identify themselves as Jewish. Doesn't matter. The point is, it's not relevant.
It does matter Because these people have Jewish privilege. They're immune to prosecution.
They're not immune to it. They're being prosecuted. They're going to probably all go to jail. Hopefully.
The ADL is instrumental in assuring that these people do not get prosecuted. The whole story of the Southern District of New York and Brighton Beach. It's written up in that book that I reviewed in Culture Wars about House of Trump, House of Russia. They were reluctant to prosecute criminals in Brighton Beach because they were Jewish. They were reluctant to prosecute them because they knew the ADL would be down on them, accusing them of anti-Semitism because they were going after criminals. It's a fact of life,
Michael,
Chuck. You can't ignore it.
I don't deny that, and I think that's a fair criticism. I'm simply pointing out that this, it's not something inherently Jewish. That's where I take issue with you. You know, you have, I mean, I could mention his name because it's a public matter, but Michael Graham, the talk show host in Washington, D.C., he got in trouble because he criticized Islam. And he read a passage from the Quran on the radio show, and the group CARE, which is connected to Hamas, they called the radio station and they had him fired for that. I'm just saying that this is not, you have gay groups who are doing this. If anybody criticizes the gay movement or criticizes transgender, they're driven out of public life. You've got black groups like Jesse Jackson shaking people down. And I mean, there's been a whole book about this. I mean, how he would go into a corporation and say, we're going to call you racist unless you put us on the board of directors. I happen to know of a situation where this happened locally. And, you know, this is a kind of corruption that has to do with what we euphemistically call political correctness. If you're not on the left and you don't genuflect properly to this liberal left establishment, then you're going to be drummed out of public life. It's nothing to do with Judaism.
Political,
it has to do with the fact that a big portion of Judaism has been co-opted by the left. But it's more of a leftist thing. It's not, you see, I think when you get into this idea that this is a Jewish thing, you're actually detracting from the real struggle. Because
political correctness is a Jewish invention.
That's nonsense. Political correctness is a Marxist invention that goes all the way back to the days of the Soviet Union when they talked about anybody
what,
that didn't
what group to... made up what group up made up the majority of the Communist Party in the United States of America? What group?
I would say that Jews made up maybe about 40% of it. A very high number, and it's a disgrace. And I've called this out in several of my books. Why is it that the Jews embraced communism? Why did Catholics embrace Nazism? Why do Muslims embrace radical Islam? These are radicalized groups of people. There's nothing to do with the faith, any of these respective faiths. The point is that the problem isn't that
it does have to do with the faith. I mean, the thesis of the Jewish revolutionary spirit is when the Jews killed Christ, when they rejected Christ, they rejected Logos, which is the topic of our discussion. Remember way back at the beginning? And I'm saying when you reject Logos, you reject the order of the universe. And when you do that, you become a revolutionary. And Jews have been revolutionaries ever since they stood there at the foot of the cross. That's the thesis of the book.
That is the thesis of your book. I respectfully reject that. I think the Jewish people have been the very bulwark of conservative values, certainly in my own lifetime. And they have stood for family. They've stood for faith. They've stood for education. They've stood for genuine human progress. They continue the very much the trajectory of Logos and of progress and of human progress. So, you know,
we've been down this road before. So I will now say, Amy Dean said Jews were behind gay marriage. And then you will say, Amy Dean is a leftist. And there you are playing Pope again. It's Pope Chuck here who's going to excommunicate the Jews that don't agree
with... I didn't excommunicate her. She's a lousy Jew in the same way that the governor of New York has said that you can have an abortion right up to the day of birth and after. Does that... He happens to be Catholic, but that's beside the point.
That contradicts the teaching of the Catholic Church.
And Amy Dean contradicts Judaism. We don't believe in gay marriage, okay? That's not in the Torah. It's not.
Why should I accept your version over Amy Dean's version?
Because you can look at the Torah. That's why. It's not my version.
I'm saying all Jews are in rebellion against the Torah in some sense or other. That is the gist of what Christ said.
I completely reject that. I respect your right to say it. We believe in the Torah, every jot and tittle. just like Jesus said to in the book of Matthew. Anyways, Michael, I want to thank you for joining me. Let my viewers and listeners know where they can get information about your books and about the Culture Wars.
Go to culturewars.com, brand new website. We're on all the social media. You can find out there.
And when's your new book coming out?
I just finished it, so it should be out soon.
All right, Michael, it's been a pleasure and an honor as always.
Good to talk to you, Chuck.
Thanks a lot.